Hot Business on Hot 102.7 with Jeremy Maggs and MoneyWeb.
Now, as South Africans continue to withdraw from their pension funds under the two-pot system, fair to say that many of us are choosing to invest offshore. However, offshore investing comes with its own complexities, including navigating difficult tax laws, ownership structures, and inheritance regulations across jurisdictions. I want to talk now to Rex Cowley, Director of Overseas Trust and Pension, who I hope is going to provide some insight into these difficulties and help us understand the risks and opportunities in global markets. Rex, good evening to you and welcome. Let's dive straight into the tax implications if we can. What do we need to consider when making that offshore decision?
Hi, good evening, Jeremy. I think the first departure point is to consider the nature of the territory that you're looking to invest in or place funds in. And if I give you an example of that, for example, you might want to go into student accommodation. That sounds like a good idea. And there's a growing university in Manchester. So you buy a flat in Manchester in the United Kingdom, giving you access to that market. That asset class is exactly the same as an asset class which you might access through an offshore center like Dublin, where you buy into a fund which buys into student accommodation. So, but the differences, the key differences there is you're accessing the same asset class, but Dublin is a tax neutral territory, which means you only have to concern yourself with the taxation of that investment that you have back in South Africa. Do you have a tax liability in South Africa in terms of any gains that you might crystallize or any dividends that are distributed? Now, there's a very different picture from the UK, where you're going to have rates on the property, you're going to have municipal rates and taxes, you're going to have income tax to pay on the income that's being distributed, and of course you're going to have accounts and maintain the whole property and all those other kind of things. But I hope that sort of serves to set the difference. Is you need to first of all figure out, are you going to go via a tax neutral route, which keeps things simple? What's the implication of that, as opposed to maybe going investing into a well-established territory directly into an asset, which brings with it a lot of complexity and cost? Possibly a better return, but definitely complexity and cost.
I was going to say, isn't this entire decision based more on return on investment rather than tax concern?
I think it is rather a personal kind of decision that people make, and it's the desire to hold, for example, bricks and mortar. It's tangible. It's a different emotional relationship you have with that than if you're just holding a fund that's invests in an example, a student accommodation. So I think there is an emotional element to the decision and not always about return. So I think there is that emotional connection that we mustn't forget, which often makes us make not necessarily the best decisions sometimes.
But the impact can be dire, and if you don't do that upfront due diligence, as you've just suggested.
I think that's absolutely right. So the first thing is, I suppose, the nature of the investment. If you're holding a collective investment scheme, it'll be a regulated structure. There may be certain protections that you will benefit from having invested in that. And there's a lot of governance around it. So you can be pretty sure that the underlying investments are being managed well and the fund is liquid and those kind of things. When you're investing your money into a property, it's a totally different kettle of fish. You have a purchase agreement, you end up with you're a sub-member of a block of flats, for example, and you've got a lot of other sort of conditions that might apply to you. So it's a very, very different contractual structure than between the two. They're very, very different structures. And of course, the one might therefore be taxed very differently. As we said, in the UK, you're looking at income tax on income, but also you now have a UK-based asset. It's based in the UK, and therefore when you pass away, how is that asset going to actually transfer to your beneficiaries, and what's the tax implications? And as we know, in the UK, we have 40% inheritance tax, and currently we have the elections in the UK, and that whole topic is being discussed. So it can be a very costly experience, maybe not necessarily for you, but definitely for those left behind, if you don't necessarily consider the broader tax implications and costs associated with the type of the investment you hold.
And Rex Cowley, I don't want this to come out the wrong way, but I'm glad you raised the issue of death, because inheritance laws and making sure that wills are valid is also critical and something that you've got to consider up front.
Yes, absolutely. There is the misconception that because your South African will says this covers your local and international assets, that that will automatically be a legal force in the country in which your assets are based. Now, of course, that's not so. Whilst it's helpful to cover your international assets in your domestic will, it doesn't mean that that will is valid in the country in which your asset is based. So the general rule of thumb is always have a will in the territory where your asset is actually located. The question is, do you actually know where that asset is located? Property is an easy thing. What if you have a contract? You know, what's the clauses in the contract? Where is the jurisdiction where the contract is written? Under what jurisdiction is it written? So those points become very, very important. Otherwise, if you're dying without a will or with an invalid will, it's a process to potentially get that invalid will validated, get probate, and then take that foreign estate, because you now have a foreign estate because you've got foreign assets, through the relevant process and out the other side. And there could be things along the way that derail the outcome that the deceased would have wanted. So, for example, there could be forced heirship laws, which means the person you intended it to go to can't under the laws of that country, or a portion only goes to them. So it's very, very important to ensure that you have a valid domestic will in that foreign country where you have assets. Includes bank accounts.
Let me pivot to something else. Let's assume that both Mrs. Maggs and I are both investing offshore. Is it advisable to have a joint account or separate accounts?
Joint accounts are something that I would say South Africans are not particularly used to, because we don't really have that concept here. We have an account where you can have signing power on. So the principles behind it are not necessarily fully understood. But a joint account outside of South Africa is an account where you both have equal right to that asset. So it doesn't mean that you have 50% and your wife has 50%. You both own the asset in its entirety. Now, the setting up of joint accounts also carries with it some additional considerations from a South African perspective, because let's say two parties put money into a joint account. There is a risk that because the other party is going to get 50% of yours and vice versa, that you could also trigger a gift tax. So a lot of people don't consider the implications of gift tax when you're setting up joint accounts. It's fine if it's husband and wife, but if you aren't husband and wife and there are other parties to that account, for example, the kids, you need to consider what's the implication. So in other words, if the kids are putting in their money, you're putting in your money, or if you're putting in all the money and they all become joint parties to it, and you're the one that's putting the cash, you're probably going to trigger some kind of donation. Whereas if everyone puts in their own bit, probably not. But it is complexity there. So I think one needs to seek advice on that from a tax perspective. And of course, when you pass away, the advantage of the joint account is the asset actually belongs to the other person in its entirety. So you don't necessarily trigger inheritance tax or estate duty in the foreign territory, which is very helpful. But at some point in time, you're going to pass away and that problem returns. So very useful to kick the inheritance can down the road. I would still say, if you're going to have a joint account, make sure that you consider the gifting element. Is there an element of gifting? Is there a donations tax? And then also still consider the implication of a joint account under a foreign will. I think that's probably the best thing to do, and you won't find yourself in hot water.
Yeah, sounds to me that kicking the can down the road is easier than kicking the bucket. Rex Cowley, thank you very much indeed. Director of Overseas Trust and Pension. I know we'll talk again. Always appreciate your time. Thank you.
Hot Business on Hot 102.7 with Jeremy Maggs and MoneyWeb.